Good Begunitz has a nice structure. It's very simple.
As an abstract abelian group, the group of units is z to the r plus s minus 1 cross t, where t is a finite cyclic group. And r and s are the number of real and complex conjugate embeddings of k into the complex numbers. So our goal really now is to give a complete proof of this theorem. Which is that the units have this structure. Now, of course, there's much more to the units than just their structure. There's what they actually are. And you have a natural problem here. Given a field, you can very easily compute R and S. You just take a polynomial that defines the field, use Newton's method, for example, to find all of the roots of that polynomial, and you can easily, you don't have to find the roots even to find R and S, but you can find R and S pretty easily. And once you've done that, modulo the problem of finding this torsion, which is not too hard either, you can figure out what the structure of this group is. But to actually find generators is a much more difficult problem in general. Already when, say, R equals 2 and S equals 0, you're in the situation of Hell's equation. And there, the solutions can be gigantic. Even when the discriminant of the field isn't very large and the degree is just 2, a real quadratic field, the actual generator for z, for this z here, can be absolutely massive. So, you know, finding the generators and writing them down, that's already an interesting problem. But what we're going to focus on right now is just proving that the unit group has this structure, which is an extremely useful input to many other theorems. So, for example, this result and a closely related result called the S-unit theorem will be a crucial input to our proof of the weak Mordell-Weil theorem for elliptic curves later. By the way, I'm going to pause for a second and tell you something about the plan for the course at this moment. So, currently what we'll do this week is prove this theorem and give examples, and next Tuesday I'm going to talk about decomposition groups and ramification and so on. And then on Thursday, Frank Caligari, that's the day right before the Harvard spring break, Frank Caligari is going to talk about Galois representations and Artin's conjecture and Langlands, that kind of stuff. And then when we get back after spring break, we'll start with elliptic curves. That's what we're going to do the rest of the time. So that's how it's broken up. And our goal with elliptic curves will be prove the weak Mordell-Weil theorem and state the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture. So that's what we're going to try to do. Okay, any questions, comments? Does that sound like a good plan? Okay, good. All right, so the first thing we'll do is proposition 914, which is that an element of OK is a unit if and only if it has norm plus or minus 1. So it's slightly tricky, actually. Only slightly tricky. K is in mu k, that is, it's a unit. So here are A is in K. A is a unit if and only if the norm of A is either 1 or minus 1. And here the domain of the A's here is K. So one direction is easier than the other. If it's a unit, then it has an inverse that's in OK. So you have that A inverse is in OK. So I'm doing this direction. A inverse is in OK. So 1, which is equal to A times A inverse. Now you take norms of both sides, and you get that the norm of 1, which is 1, it's equal to the norm of A times A inverse. The norm is multiplicative, so that's the norm of A times the norm of A inverse, which is the norm of A inverted. And actually, I'm just going to leave it like this. Norm of A inverse. And these are both integers because they're elements of OK. So So you have a product of two integers that's equal to 1. That means that the integers are either both 1 or both minus 1. So we're done in this case. Now the next case is the other direction, and that requires a little trick. So now we assume that you have some, we assume we have an A of norm plus or minus 1, and you want to show that it's a unit.
So A such that the norm of A is plus or minus 1.
Now, the norm is the product of the images of A under the various embeddings, or the product of the conjugates of A, if you like. And so it's some product, A1, A2, actually, I'll use notations. We have it sigma 1 of A, sigma 2 of A, dot dot dot, sigma n of A, where these are the embeddings of K into the complex numbers. So you have this product, and it's equal to plus or minus 1. Now, one of these sigma sub I of A's is equal to A. If you identify K with a subfield of C. So
we just identify, we'll view K as being contained in the complex numbers.
Then one of these is just A, and then the others are, you know, the other embeddings. Although you could also think about embedding, or abstractly, K into a Galois closure, and then one of the embeddings is going to be the identity, and that will fix A, and then the other ones will take it to other elements of the Galois closure. Okay? So let's just say it's the first one. So that's what the equation looks like. And now look, the inverse is staring you in the face. It's just the product of all the other ones. That's A inverse, except possibly up to sign. So this is plus or minus A inverse. And each of these sigma I of A is an algebraic integer that satisfies the same polynomial that A satisfies. So each of these are also in they're also in Z bar. Right, because each one is an algebraic integer, they're in Z bar, but they're also in K because their product, this product is in K because the product is A inverse, which is of course in K, but Z bar intersect K is just OK. So we've now shown that the inverse of A is in OK, which implies that the inverse, that it implies that A is a unit.
A is in UK.
Right, so that's the first thing. Okay, now let me explain the strategy for proving Dirichlet's unit theorem. So here's what you do. It's very conceptual, it's just that doing every step will take more than, you know, 10 minutes. So we have an embedding of K into Rn. And again, I'm going to tweak it slightly from before. We'll take this one to be, I'll call it sigma. And it's, you take sigma 1 through sigma r plus s, where sigma r plus 1 through sigma r plus s, these are half of the complex conjugate embeddings. And the notation here is, notice I put R to the end, even though half of these have image in C. I want you to identify the second, the, you know, R plus 1 through R plus S, C codomains with R cross R. So you could think of this as just being sigma 1 up through sigma R. These are the ones that have image in R. And then you take the real part of sigma R plus S, sorry, R plus 1, and the imaginary part of sigma R plus 1, and so on, all the way up through the real part of sigma R plus S, and the imaginary part of sigma R plus S. Okay? And this will just be a little bit more convenient for the proof today. So it's the third thing that I'm calling sigma is just a slight change from the previous one. But from the one we considered last time, the only difference is that instead of having all the real ones and then all the imaginary ones separated, which is better for certain things, here they're together. That's the only difference at all. Otherwise, it's completely identical. It's just reordering the end, the last few columns. So we have this embedding, and we can certainly restrict it to K star, the non-zero elements of K. It also makes sense if you consider it on the units contained in K. Now, the idea to get this structure theorem is that we're going to show that some image of the units under a homomorphism is a lattice in a certain vector space. And you know the, if you know the dimension of the vector space, and you know that something's a lattice in it, then you know the rank of the something. So that's the idea. Now, it doesn't quite work to just embed into R to the n with UK. You don't end up getting a lattice from UK. I mean, think about it. If you take an element of UK, well, I guess it's even.
It doesn't contain zero.
Yeah, it doesn't contain zero. So already you're gonna have problems trying to make a lattice using it. It's just not gonna be closed under what you want. So this is multiplicative. This UK is sort of multiplicative and Rn is additive. So you need to fix it up so you get something that really works. And the trick is to use log. So here's what you do. Define another map, again to Rn, and this time it'll only be defined, well, I guess it'll be defined here, but let's define it first on UK. And I'll call this map phi. And here's what it is. It's just, should I mess up? Phi of A for A a unit is log of the absolute value of sigma 1 of A all the way up through sigma R plus S of A.
So that's into R to the R plus S.
And oh, yeah, you're right. Because I took the, and I forgot my log here. See. So it goes into R to the R plus S. You could go into R to the N, but it would be kind of redundant. The thing is, we're taking the absolute value, so the conjugate embeddings don't give you anything new. Or more to the point, you have these two, but they're together giving you the absolute value of A, so you only get a single coordinate from it. So there's no point in using more. Okay, so what you get is there's a map from UK to R to the R plus S, and here it is. You take an element of UK, you embed it in each way, basically as before, but then you take the absolute value, and you take the log of the absolute value. And you get a nice map, and this is going to give us our lattice. So let's check that it has any chance of giving you a lattice. So to be closed under addition, if you add together two of these, then that's just like multiplying the thing inside, and that's just multiplication here. So it works, and you end up getting something that at least has a chance to be a lattice. The image of UK, what we'll show is that, well, first, it's not going to turn out to be a lattice. Already from this, you see that it couldn't be a lattice in R to the R plus S, since it has rank R plus S minus 1. But there's an obvious hyperplane, H, inside of R to the R plus S, and this map in fact lands inside of that hyperplane, which has dimension R plus S minus 1. This map phi lands inside of that hyperplane, and the image is a lattice. We'll show that the image is discrete. That won't be very difficult. Then the hard part by far is showing that the R span of the image of UK really gives you all of H. That is going to be the hard part. But we'll do it. We'll show that this has discrete image that generates H over R. So our goal is to prove that phi of UK is a lattice in H. There's there's a little bit of extra stuff we need to do at the beginning just to get things going and to see that that's really the right goal to have. What about this finite torsion group? What about the kernel of this map? We have to check that the kernel of this map is finite, and then observe that a finite subgroup of the multiplicative group of a field is cyclic. So that'll give this finite cyclic part. And I'll do that in a few seconds, in a moment. Once we have that, we'll show that the image is discrete, and that will be some easy topology, very easy. And then we'll show that the image is the whole thing, and that will be a little bit more work. It'll be a lot more work, actually. Okay, first, lemma 916, which is that the kernel's finite. There's a typo in the proof of lemma 915. I forgot absolute values around the norm of A in the displayed equation in the proof of lemma 915 on page 88. There's also a typo in lemma 916. It says, in the proof, it says R to the R plus 2S, but it should be R to the R plus S at the third from the last line right here. Okay, so now we'll prove the kernel of phi is finite.
But this is really going to be the goal. The interesting part is going to be proving that the thing is a lattice. So lemma, kernel of phi finite.
So if you have something that's in the kernel of phi, that means that it goes to 0, i.e. that each of the components is 0. That means that each of these absolute values is 1. So you have to consider the A in UK, the property that the absolute value of sigma I of A is equal to 1 for all I. So remember, at the top we have this embedding sigma, and it's kind of funny, you get to play these off against each other. You have this embedding sigma, it takes k, or even just the units, into r to the n, and we proved before that the image of ok in r to the n via this embedding is a lattice. Now look at this condition over here. This really says that if you take a unit that's in the kernel of phi and then embed it via sigma, it's just this map, that it's the image of that element has each of its entries have an absolute value 1. So every element of the kernel of phi maps via the, if you view it as an element of OK, it maps via this embedding to an element of a bounded subset of sigma of OK. I mean, it's an element of sigma of OK that lies within a bounded subset of R to the N. Sigma of OK is a lattice. Therefore, the number of elements of sigma of OK in this bounded subset is finite. If you take sigma of OK, take elements in a bounded subset, then you'll find only finitely many in there. So this set is a subset of OK. Via the sigma embedding is a subset of sigma of OK intersected with a bounded subset of R to the N. So I'll just write sigma of this whole set, a subset of sigma of OK intersected bounded subset of Rn. And this is finite because sigma of OK is a lattice. So that deals with finiteness of the kernel of this map. And the second part is that if you have, this is a subgroup of the multiplicative group of a field. If you have a finite subgroup of the multiplicative group of a field, it's cyclic. How many people already know the proof of that fun fact?
You say that one more time.
So if you have any finite subgroup of K star, or any field at all in the entire universe, then it's automatically a cyclic group. It's a really fun little thing to prove. But half of you haven't seen it. So here's how you do it. I remember this was even on the like qual exam when I was going to Berkeley as a grad student. So I remember it from that.
So if you take a field K, take any finite subgroup of
a multiplicative group.
And the reason I'm telling you this again is to prove that this is a cyclic group. We know it's finite now, but I'm going to prove it's cyclic.
So if you have any finite group at all,
you let n be the exponent of g.
So x to the n is equal to 1 for each element of g.
That is to say, every element of g satisfies the polynomial x to the n minus 1.
However, in a field, a polynomial of degree n can have at most n roots. Therefore, this group G has at most n elements. Now you're done. If you have a finite abelian group of exponent n, and it has at most n elements, it has to be cyclic. For example, imagine writing it as a product of cyclic groups. Then the least common multiple of the sizes of each factor would be the exponent, but if that's equal to the size of the group, then there can be only one factor. Okay? So it's a very simple proof, but it's kind of neat what you've proved. Of course, the real work is in proving that a polynomial of degree n has at most n roots over a field, which is not at all true if you aren't over a field. But that really belongs in algebra class for the discussion. Any questions about this? Okay. Alright, so the next step is to show that the image of phi is discrete. And remember, in order to get Dirichlet's full unit theorem, all we need to do is show that the image is a lattice. And discrete will be halfway there, in the sense of there are two things to show, and that will be one of the two things. It won't be halfway there in the sense of work, though. So this is lemma 9.1.8. It's a statement that the image of phi, that is to say, phi of uk is discrete. So this is another trick where we're going to play off the two different embeddings. So what we're going to do is take a bounded subset of r to the r plus s, take its inverse image under phi. And if we can show that's finite, we'll be set, because that will mean that the intersection, since phi has finite kernel, well, I mean, if phi had infinite kernel, then the inverse image would always be infinite, so there's nothing to worry about there. So, yeah. Well, I guess this is a bounded set, so it wouldn't have to be a subgroup. But anyways, so you take a bounded subset here, you take the inverse image, and then you push it over here, and we'll see that the image over here is bounded, so the intersection with sigma of OK will be finite, and then that will imply that the inverse image here is finite, hence the intersection of this bounded subset with phi of UK is finite. Okay, that's the strategy to prove. You have something here that you have a bounded set, you want to show that its intersection with this is finite, so you pull it back, push it forward, you know that you have finiteness here because the image is a lattice, and then that gives you what you want. But let me show you the details. So let X be a bounded subset of R to the R plus S. And let's consider phi inverse of X. This is contained in UK. And our goal, again, is to show that X has finite intersection with UK, or rather with the image of UK, with phi of UK. So if you focus for a moment on some element of this inverse image, which I'll call Y, so I'm just picking an element U in here, then the logs of the absolute values of the coordinates are
a view are all bounded just in terms of x, some single bound on that. So what we have to see is that if you have some absolute bound in the log of the absolute values of a bunch of numbers, that implies that you have a bound on the absolute values of the numbers. Okay? So, that, I mean, it's completely, doesn't matter how many numbers there are. All I'm saying is that if you have a bound on the log of the absolute value of a number, does that give you a bound on the number? And it does. I mean, the bound on the number will be much bigger. It's like exponentially bigger, but it's still bounded. And also notice that the numbers we're considering here, they're units, so they're all an absolute value. Well, actually, I don't want to use that though. So. But they're all algebraic integers, so these absolute values are all at least. Well, let's see. They're not zero if because we're in UK, so at least it makes sense to. Well, okay, I mean, but the ones we have a bunch of elements of UK, and the log of the absolute value is bounded by some absolute bound depending only on x. We just take the maximum of the coordinates of any element in x. So,
but can x contain the point zero, like?
Yeah, x certainly can. Yeah, x can contain the point 0000000. That's actually in the image of this. That's one of these. So what do we have to worry? Is there anything to worry about here? So what I want to use is that if you have a subset of r to the n that's bounded, then its intersection with sigma of OK is finite. And the subset of r to the n that's bounded will just be whatever bound you have. It'll be e to the power of whatever bound you had in the logs of these elements. I mean, that's all there is to it. So let's see if I want to say something more precise. So you consider sigma of y. This is a subset of r to the n. And y is a subset of uk, so it's certainly a subset of ok. So it's a subset of r to the n. Contained in sigma of OK, and the coordinates of sigma of y are bounded. And the bounds on the coordinates of sigma of y, that's just like you take all these units and you're getting rid of the log, taking all the absolute value of the embeddings of these units and getting rid of the log. The resulting numbers you get are still going to be bounded. It's just going to be that the bound is e to the power of the previous bound. So that's all you need. Once you know that sigma of y has the property that all the elements here are bounded, there's one bound on all these elements, then you can find a bounded subset of r to the n that contains sigma of y, and sigma of y is contained in sigma of ok, and sigma of ok intersects bounded subsets of the intersection is finite. So sigma of y has to be finite, and hence y is finite because sigma is an embedding. But y being finite implies x is finite. So the logic here is that sigma of y bounded implies that sigma of y is contained in sigma of ok intersect a bounded set. But this is finite. And that implies that sigma of y is finite. And sigma of y being finite implies that y is finite, because sigma is an embedding. Y being finite implies that x is finite, because...
Do we want to say that x intersects the image of phi is finite? Because we...
Oh, yeah, sorry. Phi, yeah, definitely. Y finite implies that x intersect the image of phi of uk, is finite. Yes. And that's it. That's what we needed. We've now shown that phi of uk is a lattice. Except for, we don't know what it's a lattice in. It's a lattice in whatever it spans. We want to show that the thing that it's a lattice in is this h, which has dimension r plus s minus 1. Given what we've shown so far,
It could be that we haven't really gotten anything. For all we know now, this thing that has discrete image, maybe the image is always zero. Maybe the image is often zero. I mean, it's pretty incredible that you can actually prove that this has image that spans H, because you're proving that just the fact you have some real and complex embeddings means that there are going to be lots of solutions to an equation, namely the norm equation for the field. Like for a real quadratic field, you have this equation which gives the norm. So if you have an element A plus B root D in a real quadratic field and you take its norm, that's A plus B root D times A minus B root D, A squared minus B squared D, and let's suppose that's equal to 1. So suppose you want to solve this equation, this equal to 1. Well, more generally, you have an equation like x squared minus y squared D equals 1, and you can wonder, does that have any solutions? And this theorem that we're proving says that, yes, as soon as r equals, since r equals 2 in the case of a real quadratic field, r plus s minus 1 is 1, and hence there will be solutions to this equation, because there will be a free abelian group of rank 1 cross some torsion that is the units, and the units all satisfy this equation or the equation with the opposite sign. So just, if you have a unit where the sign is minus 1, you can square it, and you get a unit where the sign is plus 1. So somehow we're proving that there exist solutions to the Pell equation, for example. And if you've seen that in like an elementary number theory course or something, then there's one way to prove it which involves continued fractions, and it's not exactly trivial. I mean, you have to work a little bit to prove this. But we're not just proving this for Pell's equation. We're proving that if you take any norm equation at all in any number field, take a cubic number field, whatever, you end up getting a more complicated equation. We're proving that that equation has solutions, assuming that, exactly when r plus s is greater than 1. So we're proving the existence of and constructing somehow lots and lots and lots of solutions to Diophantine equations. So it's pretty incredible that you can do that. And you do it just by some topology and formalism. But we haven't done it yet. All we've done so far is shown that the image is discrete and has finite kernel. So the really hard, interesting part is showing there are actually things in this image. All right, so I'm going to prove lemma 9.19 next, and it will probably look very unmotivated because it doesn't so clearly look like it's related to what we're doing. But trust me, it will be extremely useful in a minute when we finish this proof, when we prove that there are really things in the image. Here's the somewhat technical-seeming lemma that you'll be really glad we proved later. So let n greater than or equal to 2 be an integer, and suppose you have w1 through wn real numbers, and they're not all equal. And you have two positive real numbers A and B. Okay, that's the setup. Then there are positive real numbers D1 through Dn. There's a typo in the notes, I don't specify that they're positive there. But in the proof they're positive. So there are D1 through Dn in R greater than 0 such that W1 log D1 plus dot 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 plus WN log DN is greater than B, and the product of the WIs, the DIs, sorry, is equal to A. Okay, so it'll be very natural to want to prove something like this in a few minutes. And it'll be very nice to have this clean statement. And this is not difficult at all to prove. It's completely elementary. So that's why I'm stating it now and proving it. So first, what does it say? It says, if these aren't all the same, then you could somehow choose the D's subject to this constraint that their product is A, so that they're as big as you want. Since the B is just some input of the theorem. So it's just saying you can make this arbitrarily large. This expression can be made arbitrarily large. And having N of these things isn't really that relevant. Since the WIs aren't all equal, after reordering, you could assume that W1 is non-zero. Something obviously wrong, because if they're all zero, it wouldn't be true. So
they're not all equal.
Not all equal, and
they're not all equal. They can't all be zero.
Ah, very good. But what could be? Well, okay. So there's a special case, which would be if n were 2, and one of them were 0, the other one wasn't 0, we have to check that this is obvious, but then it's obvious, because you get to choose the one where it is 0, you get to choose that other d, so there's no constraint here. Okay, so there's no problem at all. It's right exactly as I stated it. Okay, so say w1 is non-zero by reordering, and w2, we don't care. So you have W1 and W2. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to set D3 through Dn all equal to 1. So they just completely disappear from the problem, because the logs of 1 are all equal to 0. So you have W1 and W2. And then just to simplify matters, just decide, since we have to choose the Di, the lemma is that given the setup, you can choose Di's so that this expression gets really big. That's all. So just set D3 equal to D4 equal dot 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 equal to Dn equal to 1. And now I can just imagine, I've now reduced to the case n equals 2, and I'll prove it there. So we're looking at now W1 log D1 plus W2 log D2. And we want to show that this gets really big, bigger than any number you choose for choices of D. And our W1's not zero, and let's see, how about if we just furthermore assume that, or we could have just assumed from the start that W1 is bigger than W2. Yeah, because I wouldn't want W1 to equal W2, and I didn't explicitly write that. So this condition, really the best way to replace it would just be to write, reorder them so that W1 is bigger than W2. Choose the biggest one of the WIs to be W1, and then you would have this. And just forget about the other ones. So for example, W1 is the max of the WIs. Okay, so now there's this constraint, D1 through Dn, that product is supposed to be equal to A, and all of these are equal to 1, so all this constraint says is that D1 times D2 is A. That is to say that D2 is equal to A over D1. So let's just substitute that into this expression. So W1 log D1 plus W2 log A over D1. And this is W1 log D1 plus W2 log A, which is constant, minus W2 log D1. Okay, so this is constant. And now, combine together the log of D1 terms, and you get that W1 log D1 minus W2 log D1 plus this constant W2 log A. And here you have, well, W1 is bigger than W2. You can choose D1 however you want. This doesn't change. And since W1 is not equal to W2, this goes to infinity as D1 goes to plus infinity. So that's it. That's what you needed to show.
So this skyrockets as d1 goes to infinity.
So we'll find this useful, and it was completely elementary to prove it. All right, so now for the real work.
Or the real fun.
Okay, so in order to accomplish this goal, let's let W equal the span under R of the image of phi. And what we want is that W is equal to H.
We want that that's H.
And the strategy of the argument will be the following. First, it's clear that W is contained in H. And in fact, I think I mistakenly omitted proving that. This actually goes into
defined H yet.
Oh, I haven't even defined H. So, all right, let's do a little background on what our H is. I slipped my mind to tell you precisely what H is, except it's some hyperplane of dimension R plus S minus 1. So let's figure out what natural linear condition anything in the element of phi satisfies. I mean, anything in the image of phi satisfies, and that'll tell us what H has to be. So if you take an element A in UK, you apply phi to it, you get phi of A, which is log of absolute value sigma 1 of A, comma dot dot dot, comma log absolute value of sigma n of A.
Is
that R plus S tuple? Now remember, right at the beginning, we proved...
R plus S.
Oops, yeah. It's not R plus S tuple, not n tuple. At the beginning, we proved that the norm of a unit is plus or minus 1. And here we almost have... I mean, there's something related to the norm of a unit on the right-hand side. Namely, if you were to basically add these up, but weight the imaginary, the ones that aren't real, with a factor of 2, then you would end up getting log of the norm of a unit. The norm of a unit is plus or minus 1, but you're taking the absolute value, so it's the log of absolute value of plus or minus 1, so you get 0. So the condition that you want is that...
So what you have is that log of sigma 1 of A plus dot 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 plus log absolute value of sigma R of A plus 2 log absolute value of sigma of R plus 1 of A plus dot 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 plus 2 log absolute value of sigma of R plus S of A.
This is just by properties of logarithms. I'm going to show it's 0.
It's equal to log of, now you take the product, sigma 1 of A times dot 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 times sigma R of A times sigma R plus 1 squared of A, an absolute value, times dot 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 times sigma R plus S of A squared.
That's what it is. And we have the squares of each of the complex conjugate embeddings, but we only have half the complex conjugate embeddings, but we're taking the absolute value. So what you get here is exactly the same as taking all the complex conjugate embeddings. So
it's like if you have x plus iy, then you take its absolute value, you get square root of x squared plus y squared, and
if you then square it, you get
x squared plus y squared, and that's exactly the product of the two images
of x plus iy under the embeddings. It's x plus iy times x minus iy. So more generally here, this is exactly the same as log of the absolute value of the product of all the sigma i's as I goes from 1 to n. But that's the norm of a unit inside, at the very inside there. So this is log of 1, which is 0. So we have a linear condition on the elements of the image of the map phi. Namely, if you add up the first R place, the first R components, plus 2 times the
remaining S components, you get 0. So the hyperplane is the hyperplane defined by this linear condition. H is the set of x1 through xr plus s such that x1 plus dot 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 plus xr plus 2 xr plus 1 plus dot dot plus 2 xr plus s is equal to 0. So that's H. And in figuring out what the definition of H should be, I've proved that phi has image contained in H. Now the goal is to show that if you let W be the span, as we did before, we want to show that W is equal to H. This is what we want. So it's clear that W is contained in H. We just did that. So if we could show H is contained in W, we would be set. So we need H contained in W. Now here's a little trickery. I'm going to prove this by showing you that W perp is contained in H perp, where by perp I mean the orthogonal complement with respect to the dot product on R to the N. I.e., so getting this is the same as W perp being contained in H perp. So what we'll do is we'll take So to show this inclusion, we're going to take an element of H, an element not in H perp, and show it's not in W perp. So it gets, but that, I mean, that's perfectly valid logic. If we can show that anything not in here is not in here either, then you have an inclusion. Okay, so that's how we'll show this. Strategy: show any V that's not in H perp, or V not in H perp is also not in W perp. So that's what we want. So we'll take a V that isn't in H perp and we'll show that's not in W perp. Okay, call this, in my notes I call it Z, so I'm going to change it. Okay, so call the entries of Z, Z1 through ZR plus S, and define a function f of x, which is Z1 log of sigma 1 of x, plus dot 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 plus z r plus s log of sigma r plus s of x. So what this is you take an element of uk and you take its image under phi and then you dot it with z. That's what this map does. And it actually makes sense on all of k star. The only requirement for this for log of something to make sense is that something isn't zero. So in fact, let's view f as a function on k-star. So map from k-star to the real numbers. And if we can show that this isn't the zero function, then we'll know that there's something in w that is not orthogonal to z, which will mean that z is not in W perp. To show that z is not in W perp means you want to show there's something in the image of this map for which you don't get zero. Being in W perp, if z were in W perp, that would mean that whenever you dot anything in W, like I take anything in the image of this map and dot it with z, you get zero. So you want to show the whole problem has now been reduced to showing that this function f is not the zero function.
That's what this says here. This show, if it's not an H perp, it's not in W perp. So we just want to show this isn't the zero function. And basically, notice that this looks very similar to this sort of thing here. And we'll have some control, and we'll be able to use that this kind of expression gets very big to show that this function can't possibly be the zero function. That's the basic strategy. So our goal is to show f is not the zero function. Once we show that, we will have it. So f is not identically zero. So this means f is not identically zero, not the zero function. And amazingly, that's it. I mean, once you show that f is not the zero function in the setup that we have, you'll have proven that there exist solutions to Pell's equation and any norm equation for which r plus s minus 1 is bigger than 0. So it's quite extraordinary. All right, so now to actually do that, this is the top of page 90. And here, the strategy is that you define a set S, you apply Bitschfeld's lemma, and you end up getting a helpful element. But then it kind of gets more complicated. You have to use some work with ideal classes, construct some things, and then eventually you get yourself into a situation where this lemma just does it for you. But it takes some work to set it up. It's not just follow your nose and use Blitchfield once in an obvious way. There's a little bit more work than that. So it's somewhat elaborate, but it's really, I mean, it's probably the biggest thing we're going to prove in here. At least about algebraic number theory. So let's see, I think I'll erase here. Are there any questions at this point? So our goal is to show that if you have something that it's not orthogonal with H perp. We're going to use that somehow to show that it's not orthogonal to W either. It's not orthogonal to H, it's not orthogonal to W. And that will give us the conclusion that we want. Okay, let's take a 3-minute break before we dive into the next part.
I did 3 grades and 11.
Okay.
I wrote about half of 13 and haven't finished it yet because it turned out to be harder than I thought.
Yes, so you can write that. Yeah, we had about only 20 minutes.
1-8, 11, and 13. Timer is 14, like, intangible.
Yeah.
And 12? I mean, what is up to this thing?
Yeah, that's like...
How do you do
this? Well, for starters, you could be Irish.
And?
I don't know. I'm not Irish, so I don't
so, like,
know.
So, like, how do you jump into it?
Yeah.
Show?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Which we were fine, and the one was a fun problem. But,
if you assume that thing you did in the first piece is 9, right?
I don't think that matters for them. I actually ended up using it on 1. But, good for 9.
Yeah, I used it on 1. You just smooth everything into 1, right? You sort of say that decent, you can always move it to the right.
Well, sort of basically just compared a bunch of inclusions where one of them, let's say, like.
I mean, because it's
so
a refinement,
like,
of Sprenger. Well, Sprenger.
Well,
BN is a refinement.
I mean, basically, you just like find a sequence of inclusions that can be from either end of a post set to a common rank, like to a rank where all the elements are in cardinality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if n is even, that's easy. You just, you know, keep moving in one step at a time towards the seller.
No, if n's even, you can just use BN on it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because the maximum rank
yeah.
is the one in the middle, and you already have it.
Well, no, you actually don't have it if B is a multiple of 2, but not 4. Like, with 6, the maximal rank is the subset of size 3.
Well, okay, fine. I mean,
we can do something like that. Yeah. You know, so what happens in the other case, but like, when an audit, you just take from the last problem set, you know that there's a rejection from, like, you know, k to n minus k, so you use that to sort of get over the middle set you don't have.
No,
like, even injection.
So J2 comes in is like all the young tablas. What are by inclusion?
I don't think they're not young tablas, are they? Well, maybe, actually, yeah, maybe they are. Yeah, I think so.
What's J of X?
I don't even know. Yeah, 7. How did you do 7? Did you do a commentary? Because I just said, like...
No, I was trying to find a graph for the longest time, and I couldn't.
Well, the problem is that the determinant is, like, negative half the time, so you need to find some transformation. No, it doesn't. I mean, I just said, I'm going to expand by minors. Here's,
mm-hmm.
here's a big recurrence.
And this somehow worked.
Yeah.
All right, that's good.
That's an actual reason.
I don't think we'll be able to finish today, unfortunately, but we'll certainly get a good chunk of the way there. So first, I'm going to... It's sort of funny. You set up Blitchfield's lemma. You apply it to sigma of OK. We can't apply it to... phi of uk, the log embedded thing, yep, because we don't know we have a lattice. But sigma of ok, we know that's a lattice, we can apply Blitchfeld to that. So we're going to set up Blitchfeld, we're going to get a certain algebraic integer. Then we're going to use a very strange trick to get from an algebraic integer to a unit. And then we're going to use the unit to here. We're going to plug the unit in right here and get that this is not zero. But it'll take a little work to do that. But it's a tricky proof.
Okay, so here's, we're going to apply Blitchfeld, and our setup is we have sigma of OK in R, Rn,
yeah, in Rn, okay, because sigma is sigma 1 through sigma R plus S, but you have the real and imaginary parts,
so you count it as twice.
Okay, so I have sigma of OK in here,
and let's let A equal, and this will be the A that gets plugged into the lemma later.
A is equal to square root of the absolute value of the discriminant times 2 over pi to the power of s. And this is, of course, a positive real number. So that's the first thing. And now second,
let's just choose any real numbers, positive real numbers, C1 through C n, such that C1, the product C1 through CR and CR plus 1 squared up through CN squared is equal to A.
So
it's R plus S.
So you choose these however you want, and I'm going to use, given this choice, I'm going to define a set S that satisfies the conditions of Blitchfeld's lemma, and then apply it. And it will turn out that we'll be able to prove, once we see what happens for a given choice, we'll be able to see sort of what happens related to this expression way over here. We'll be able to then apply this lemma and see that we could have chosen the CI in such a way so that we make this thing way over there non-zero. That's the idea. So we'll prove something. We'll prove as much as we can for any choice at all, and then we'll show that there exists a choice that works. Okay. Okay. So choose these, and now here's the kind of almost the canonical type of set to define. So S is going to be, it's just the product of a whole bunch of intervals and a whole bunch of circles. So it's the set of elements x1 through xn in Rn, in our vector space, such that the absolute value of xi is less than or equal to ci for I equals 1 up through r, and the absolute value of xi, I want to write this clearly, so xi squared plus xi plus s squared is less than or equal to ci squared for the other i's, I going from R plus 1 through R plus S. So visually you should think of this as it's a disk in R1 of radius CI, a whole bunch of those, and then you have these disks in R2 of radius CI. So it's a product of a bunch of disks in R1 and R2. Where a disk in R1, I just mean an interval. So it's just a bunch of intervals and then a bunch of circles, or disks. So it's a product of those. Hence, it's convex and symmetric and bounded and et cetera, et cetera. You have a question?
Do you want to say xi squared plus xi plus 1 squared since the R map is not different?
Oh. Yeah, you're right.
Definitely.
And for iu.
Yeah, no, it's... Wait, what's the second?
Second thing is that, like, you want them, you know, you want for some particular parity of I.
Oh, no, so annoying. You're right.
R plus 1.
Way less complicated. Okay. I'll just write I equals R plus 1, R plus 3, etc. Okay, and then it goes up to R plus 2s.
R plus 2s minus 1.
Minus 1. Thank you. Alright, so that's our set S. It satisfies the conditions of Blitzschild's lemma. So now we need a lattice. The lattice to take is L equals sigma of OK. And now we have to check the condition, which is that the volume of S is sufficiently large so that it will have to have a non-zero intersection with L. And that will work. It'll just fall out of the definitions we've made so far. So first we'll calculate the volume of S. And we already know from our work with determinants that the volume of R to the n mod sigma of L is 2 to the, or minus 1 to the, wait, what is it exactly? 2 to the minus S square root of the opposite value of the discriminant of the field.
You just mean mod L, right?
Yeah, because I already put the sigma in. Thank you. So the volume of R to the n mod L is 2 to the minus s square root of dk, and we need that the volume of S is 2 to the n times as big as this, I think, in order to apply Blitzschild's lemma. Yes. So let's figure out what the volume of S is and make sure that it's at least 2 to the n times as big as the volume of R to the n mod L. So the volume of S, well, there, you just multiply together the areas of each of these. So here you have a whole bunch of 2 times CIs. So 2C1 all the way up through 2CR. Then next, after that, you have the areas of these circles. And the area of a circle is pi times the radius squared. So it's pi CR plus 1 squared times all the way up to pi CR plus S squared. So multiplying it all together, you get 2 to the R, C1 through CR, pi to the S, CR plus 1 squared, up through CR plus S squared. And there's a quick simplification. You have this A being equal to the product of the CIs with the squares at the end. So there, we can substitute this product, except for the pi to the s, to the r pi to the s times a, where a is, nicely enough, square root of the absolute value of the discriminant times 2 over pi to the s. And now, the pi to the s's cancel, and you get 2 to the r plus s times the square root of the opposite value of the discriminant. And fortunately, that's exactly 2 to the n times 2 to the minus s square root of the opposite value of the discriminant, where that last thing is the volume of r to the n mod l. So we're exactly in the situation where you can apply Blitzschild's lemma. Blitzschild's lemma tells us that because this s has a volume that's sufficiently large compared to l, there is an a that's in the intersection that's not zero. Okay, now we have to think about what properties this A has. What does it mean to be in that intersection? Well, it exactly means that the embeddings in absolute value of A, so the sigma I of A, satisfy a certain constraint coming from this. So for example, for I equals 1 to R, sigma sub I of A has absolute value less than or equal to Ci. And now what we're going to do is we're going to combine that fact with the fact that A is an algebraic integer, and we'll be able to get some precise upper and lower bounds on the absolute values of the images of A under sigma, and that will be very useful. There's a typo in the notes, which is that kind of the conclusion we want to get to is equation 914, and the inequalities are backwards in that as I've written them, I think. They're correct in the line right before, but not in on page 91. They're not correct in the display equation 9.1.4. All right, so we applied Buchfeld. We have an element A. It's in the intersection. It's not zero. Now let's see what we can do with it. So first, okay, the first observation is the norm of A is bounded. The norm of A is, by definition, the product of the absolute values of the sigma i's of A. This is the absolute value of the norm. And you can separate this because we're taking the absolute value. You can write it as first the product as I goes from 1 to R of absolute sigma I of A times the product as I goes from R plus 1 to R plus S sigma I of A squared. Or I can square the opening either way. So because I'm taking absolute values, I can combine together the complex conjugate embeddings at the expense of putting a square. But these absolute value of sigma I's are, they're bounded because this A is in the set S. So we have a bound here and a bound on the square of the absolute value here. So this quantity is less than or equal to the product C1 up through CR times CR plus 1 squared up through CR plus S squared. And this is equal to A by definition. So first, the A that we got from Buchfeld's lemma, its norm is at most A. Doesn't sound good when you're seeing it. So the little a we got has norm, it's little, it has norm at most capital A. So that's an upper bound, and now we need a lower bound. And we'll get that from the fact that A is an algebraic integer. So there's a lower bound, which is that 1 is less than or equal to the norm. The norm is an integer, so the norm of an algebraic integer is a rational integer, so we have this. The absolute value of that norm is at least 1. So if any individual absolute value of sigma I of A were smaller than, so it's tricky here because I have to do these two different cases. So I'm going to show you what you recover from this. So basically what we're going to see is that if any one of the individual embeddings were less than Ci divided by A, then you would get another inequality like this, but you would replace Ci by Ci divided by A. I'm just talking about the first few here. And that would give you something that would be strictly less than 1 right here. Okay? So that's how I'm going to get an upper bound on each of the lower bound on each of the individual things. So the goal is equation 9.1.4. And that's that Ci over sigma I of A in absolute value is greater than or equal to A. This is for I going from 1 up through R. And the other thing is that Ci over absolute sigma I of A, the whole thing squared, that's bigger than or equal to A for the other I's. Okay, and again, it's just that if this wasn't true, you'd have that one of the absolute sigma i's would be less than or equal to ci over a. So when you went through this, instead of just putting ci here, you'd have ci divided by a. That's what you do for that one particular factor. And then you would just get something that's strictly less than 1. So you certainly have that it has to be bigger than or equal to a for each one. Because if even a single one is less, you get that the whole thing is, has norm less than 1. But the norm is greater than or equal to 1 in this. And likewise over here with the square, if a sigma I squared were less than or equal to ci squared over a, instead of putting, when you go from sigma I squared to ci squared down here, instead of doing that, you would go from sigma I squared to ci squared divided by a. And that would, in this equation, again, give you something strictly less than 1, a contradiction. So you have greater than or equal to a in both cases. Okay. So that's another important, useful bound that we'll use. All right, now here's the funnest part of the proof. We're going to take this a and get from it a unit in a clever way. I mean, it's kind of weird because we got an a that we hope is useful somehow, but we don't have a unit. And it's really tricky because you think, how can I get a unit using Blitzschild's lemma when all it gives me is an algebraic integer? But there is a trick to get a unit. So we have those bounds over there, which we'll use in a minute. And now what we want to do is go from having a to a unit. And then once we have that unit, it's a matter of using this lemma to get what we want. So you have this, you have the ideal generated by a. And what's the norm of this ideal? It's just the norm of a. So the norm of this ideal is equal to the norm. It's confusing me, actually. Ah, okay, I see. Okay. So, I think I want to totally leave you hanging, actually. So, it'll be perfect on Thursday to state the lemma, state the setup, so you really have your head around what we're about to do. And then I'll tell you how to get this unit, and we'll have plenty of time to really go through the proof. As it is now, I'm going to completely run out of time right in the middle without any sort of preparation for running out of time. So I'm going to stop right now. This is the middle of page 91. And we have a page and a half left, so we have about 15 minutes left in the proof. We're going to do that first thing next time. And what I'll do now is give you the midterm and possibly make a couple of remarks about it. Okay, so here's the midterm. It's the rules are, I hope, precisely stated at the top, and I'm sure they aren't precisely enough stated for you guys. So, first is 25% of your grade. You have to turn it in right at the beginning of class on Thursday. It's exactly 4 problems. The point value of each problem kind of varies depending on how difficult I thought it might be to some extent. You should just use the course notes in the course textbook. You can use Magma and Perry if you want, though. In fact, you should be able to do every problem here without using a computer. They're all conceptual. But you're welcome to do experimentation and try one however much you want. You shouldn't use the internet or talk to people about the problems on here. And I don't think it should take you 48 hours to do. I think it should be a lot less. One thing is that I've worded when possible, the problems in a somewhat open-ended fashion, in the sense that prove or give a counterexample. In number theory, in algebraic number theory, if you do it a lot, you'll discover that the best strategy by far is always be very optimistic. It's not like analytic number theory. Algebraic number theory, optimism is a very, very good move to take. So my recommendation regarding prove or give or counterexample type problems is it's generally a better idea to be an optimist rather than a pessimist, in number theory at least. Usually the patterns you see in number theory work. Yes?
So how many times should we be an optimist, and how many times should we be a pessimist? On average.
I stand by my previous statement that I just said. You should put a big smiley face at the top of the exam and think, I am an optimist. You take this. I think that's the way to go. Since the class officially ends in 5 minutes, how about if you look over the problems right now, and if anyone has any questions about what I'm asking, I can try to clarify what is being asked. So I'll just shut up and let you look at this. It's on the web page now, too. But it will.
Question.
Yes.
About 3C, if I'm reading it right. So you say that big phi of L is a map from CL to CK, but at the beginning, then in C you say the big phi of L sends every element of CK
okay.
to the identity CL.
I think it's
CL.
Psi. It should be Psi L.
Okay.
I think I switched Psi L and Phi L in the note and part C. I mean, yeah, so certain about that. It should be the one that goes up. Yeah, it should be psi L. So from the small field to the big field. So in problem 3C, that should be psi L. So the statement sends every element of CK to the identity, that's what I want. I want the via the natural map induced on class groups going up, every element goes to the identity in L. And in the comment, then, the psi should be changed to phi. So just swap phi and psi in the small note and then see.
The note as well?
Yes, in the note, it should be phi instead of psi.